Blog Talk Radio. The date is March 24, 2011, Washington, D.C., planet Earth, third planet from the sun. I'm your host, Dr. C. Robert Jones. The call-in line is 347-884-8500. And for those of you who are on a budget, 877-666-9305. We're continuing yesterday's program, asking the question that's on a lot of folks' minds these days with all the wars and rumors of wars and earthquakes and tsunamis, famine. Is the apocalypse upon us, and is Barack Obama the Antichrist? I see American citizens in the room, along with a few guests who are probably listening on their computers. Something Obama said during the campaign that didn't get much notice. Like a lot of things that Obama said during the course of the campaign that really didn't seem to resonate with folks until much later. But first, well, let's quote him. It was usually an effective tactic, another one of those tricks I had learned. People were satisfied so long as you were courteous and smiled and made no sudden moves. They were more than satisfied. They were relieved. Such a pleasant surprise to find a well-mannered young black man who didn't seem angry all the time. A quote from Dreams of My Father, Barack Obama, presidential candidate. Smiling faces sometimes pretend to be your friend. Can you dig it? The underlying theme of black liberation theology. The theology subscribed to by Reverend Jeremiah Wright, who was Barack Obama's minister and friend for over 20 years, is that blacks in America have seething hatred for whites. Is that true? Some do. I know a few. And in this regard, Obama is a typical black person. Or so it would seem. How deep is this black liberation theology hatred of the white race? If one scratches the surface, it seems endemic in the black American community. All economic and social strata are affected. Or, if you prefer, programmed by it. I'm a black man myself. The voice you hear is the voice of a black man. I don't consider myself to be African American. My lineage is so far removed from the African continent that I believe it would be disingenuous to label myself an African American. And besides that, we black folks have been, three, four different titles over the course of my existence on this planet. Well, we were Negro. Then we were black. And now we're African American. So that's three. So I'm just going to go ahead and pick one. And I did. And I'm just plain old black. So, a few months ago, in Atlanta, Superior Court Judge Marvin Arrington, a black judge, asked all the white folks to leave his courtroom so that he could have a chat with the blacks. And there was nothing untoward going on. He later explained, when forced to apologize for his actions, that he just wanted to have a black-only chat. Those were his exact words. With the various defendants, all black, mind you, one would assume and explain to them, well, one would assume that they were all black. But he wanted to explain to them that killing people was wrong. And I believe that's something that we probably should have learned like a long time ago, that we wouldn't need a judge to explain that to us, that our parents would have taught us that. But apparently the judge felt that some of these folks were devoid of proper parental guidance as children, and that it needed to be explained to them that killing folks was wrong. Maybe they'd finally get it because he was wearing the black robe and he was a black man. Who knows? But I know for sure that if a white judge had asked that all blacks remove themselves from the courtroom so that he could talk to the whites only, there would not only be demands that he be immediately removed from the bench, sued, impeached, perhaps imprisoned, tarred and feathered, and run out of town on a rail. No doubt. Look, nobody should really be upset with Judge Arrington. There's no doubt that his intent was benign. And at the worst, he should have suffered through a class of racial sensitivity or two. But one result of our quest for a colorblind judicial system is a rigid set of rules that cannot be relaxed by the use of common sense or reason. Hence, a meek honor roll student who is found to have accidentally left a plastic butter knife in his or her car somehow receives the same penalty that a student who is a known psychopath found wandering the halls of academia with a sharpened machete in his or her hand does. Now, where is the justice in that? When a small child brings in a tiny little, infinitesimal little plastic gun, erroneously or mistakenly left in his pocket, taken from his G.I. Joe, is treated as a criminal, treated as if he had brought in a 9mm Glock, fully loaded, ushered out of school, suspended, and then given a talking to by the police. Logical distinctions. Subjective evaluations have fallen by the wayside in our school system and in our judicial system. And this is all the result of race. It's not Arrington, Judge Arrington. It's not him. It's the system. The system we've evolved to end racism actually winks and nods at black racism. Many blacks take advantage of this, and Obama is right about one thing. The typical white person is scared of black folks, and in some cases, rightly so. But in the court system or the school system, you can't color outside the lines. If you do, if white, you'll be accused of racism. Because of racial sensitivity at perceived slights, subjective interpretation of rules cannot be allowed. However, subjective feelings by black people of being discriminated against by white people are almost always allowed. Even the supposed objectivity of numbers and statistics is not safe from the charge of racism. In a multiracial society, there'll always be statistics, positive and some negative, that are unequal between various races and cultures. If, therefore, any subjective evaluation can be shown to have come into play in the generation of inevitable uneven statistics, for example, the number of black kids in a certain high school who receive discipline versus the number of white kids who receive discipline, there'll be screams of outrage that racism is responsible for the disparity. This is the true code that Judge Arrington violated. He used a little common sense and a little compassion, but it was applied subjectively by race. And that is a no, hell no. Now, I am a typical black person, perhaps not so typical. I'm a Republican. I'm a conservative. I'd vote for a black person for president. I did not. I'd vote for, Condoleezza Rice, who's intelligent, has tons of foreign policy experience, and respect for the Constitution. But certainly not Barry Obama, who thinks smiling at white folks is a neat trick. and who speaks to voters with pimp seductiveness while harboring his real plan, or harboring, which is to put his bitch America on the street like a $20 hoe. Now, I didn't say whore either. I said hoe. You know, I'm always encountering black Americans, African Americans, who are intelligent, fair, and reasonable people. In fact, I've met lots of my black brothers and sisters who are smarter, stronger, richer, harder working, better looking, more compassionate, and more patriotic than even me. And that's saying an awful lot. And, of course, most of them are even better dancers. But I'm seriously beginning to wonder if they are rare creatures. Nonetheless, I've always felt I owed a duty to the principle of equality. Not for just black folks. Not to equate what I'm saying with what the Reverend Al Sharpton says, that he will not rest until he makes everything equal in everybody's house. No idea what that means. Well, I have some idea. Well, I strive to diligently, I diligently strive to accept all Americans by the content of their character, not their color. Virtually all of the white Americans I associate with feel the same way, but not all of my black brothers and sisters. When I encounter overt racial hostility, it's from black folks, not whitey. 90% of the time, it's always white. I mean, black toward white. I sometimes have to strive against creeping feelings of hostility toward my black brothers and sisters for being so narrow-minded and so racist. Now, I have heard over the course of my development as a young man that it's impossible for black people to be racist. Well, that's I found as I grew older and became a man to be just a damnable lie. But because I care and because I adhere to certain principles, I do strive. And that is the point to me. Not to be free of common natural human feelings, but to hold to principles that are higher than a purely emotional reaction. And my concern is this. It's not that the other America, black America, is just culturally different from white folks or white America, but that it is fueled by racist hatreds of whites. And when that embedded racism enters the political channel, I should not be expected to be tolerant of it. I will not have my rights as a citizen abrogated by anyone, white or black, or Hispanic, or Asian, or anybody I left out. Now, Barack Obama is a product of this alternate America, as I call it, this anti-American, anti-white, black liberation theology. Now, Let's talk about black liberation theology for just a moment, give you a bit of its history. 1966 is when it came into play. Spawned by Afrocentrism, a ludicrous reinvention of history that has the Egyptians as black Africans who flew around the skies of North Africa on wings, a black Jesus, and even and yeah, every major player in history, except perhaps George Washington, as being of sub-Saharan origin. I remember as a young man hearing the phrase put upon me all the time, "We are descendants of kings and queens." That would have to be an awful lot of kings and queens for all of us to be descendants of kings and queens. But even though that thought went through my head when I would hear that we are descendants of kings and queens, I didn't say anything. I was like, yeah, okay. Yeah, every single one of us. Like, okay. Reverend Wright. Reverend Wright subscribes to black liberation theology. Barack Obama sat in Reverend Wright's pew for more than 20 years, was married by the black theologian. Children baptized in his church. Huh. His disciple, I would call Barack Obama, the former presidential candidate, formerly known as Barry Obama, sat at his feet for 20 years, soaking it all up. Barry's negative feelings about whites are at this time a matter of public record. Scribbled by his own hand, there's nothing in his early policy statements to suggest at some point he suddenly had an epiphany that white people weren't the devil incarnate. When one reads about Afrocentrism, the natural question arises, why would anyone with half a brain adopt such a belief system? We find an illustrative example of the seductive power of hating whitey in this example. For several decades, a hedonist black con man named Dwight York, a.k.a. Imam Isa, leader of the Asherah Allah community, prophet, God incarnate, and leader of the Nubian nation of Moors, Dr. Shalaj Z. York, Dr. Love, disco musician, Islamic Messiah, Chief Black Isa, Muhammad Isa Al, blah, 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 blah. You get the picture. Oh, a leader of the Nubian Islamic Hebrews, can't forget that. He stole money, of course, kept black Americans as virtual slaves, and in many cases, in conditions that actual slaves didn't have to endure. He sexually abused countless women and molested hundreds of children, boys and girls, some as young as 4 years old. Do you hear me talking? He was also suspected of being involved in murder, arson, and bank robbery. The FBI was interested in his criminal empire, as were authorities in New York and later in Georgia, where his cult found purchase in the book. The book called Ungodly. No which documents York's life as a pedophile and explores his criminal odyssey in politically correct America. Author Bill Osinski, I hope I pronounced that right, asked two intriguing questions. How was York able to escape prosecution for so long? And two, why did reasonably intelligent black persons fall for his ludicrous ruse and in many cases stay on after they found out his so-called religious stances were a fabric of lies and had either direct knowledge or had been exposed to rumors of his sexual proclivity for children? Ask, why did they continue to support him? Why, indeed. Well, we'll get to that in a moment, but first let's take a short break.
This is Economic Jeopardy, where your elected officials jeopardize your future. Let's meet our contestants. From Nevada, the man who passes bills that he hasn't even read, Senator Harry Reid. His hobbies include hunting, blackjack, and blaming George Bush. From Ohio, the Speaker of the House, who is good at speaking about spending cuts, Representative John Boehner, Mr. Speaker. He enjoys a good smoke after dinner and being outdoors in the sunshine. And sitting in for President Obama is Prompton, the president's teleprompter. Inside Prompton are the components of the federal government that provide multiple redundancies, overlapping programs, leading to a low performance threshold. And now, here's your host of Economic Jeopardy, Alex Quebec.
In this exciting game, we've started the contestants at the same level as our national debt, negative 14 trillion, which is 92 trillion in yen. Today's topics are earmarks, entitlements, spending cuts, debt ceiling, and reducing $14 trillion debt. Speaker Boyardiner, what topic would you like to choose?
I don't think I have one off the top of my head.
Well, Speaker Bahouni, how about spending cuts?
Read my lips. We're going to cut spending.
We know there have to be cuts made, and we need them.
We see, Senator Reid, that you proposed reducing your $14 trillion debt to $13,990,000,000,000. Okay, perhaps the president programmed his teleprompter to actually choose a topic.
I'll take Marriage Protection Act for $1,000, Dave.
That's not a topic, and my name's not Dave.
Childhood obesity for $300.
No, none of those are actually...
Democratic fundraisers for $1,000,000.
Republicans have blocked everything. They do not want us to accomplish anything.
Say, Dave, can I keep the secret? $105 billion from healthcare?
Hello! Contestants, please.
I'm not laughing because it's not funny.
So will none of these guys even try to solve our debt problem?
Hell yes, I can.
Promotional consideration provided by Pelosaroni, the San Francisco treat, a liberal supply of donkey wax. And one lucky contestant will go home with a golfer's dream vacation package. Economic Jeopardy was rendered before a digital audience.
Will be so pissed.
Stop talking. Class has begun.
Class?
Yes, class. The school board agreed that you all need to learn economics. Now, you all know why you're here. To learn economics. And why do you need to learn economics?
Because the economy is trapped right now, and we're in an investment, and we're spending tons of money to bail out these stupid banks that just gave money to a bunch of idiots who never paid it back. And now the government is taking billions of dollars to save these banks, when all some of them do is take big vacations, and we're all going to die. See us going home now.
Dude, what was that?
Uh-oh, you get back here.
So, you think you really understand all that, and you don't need my class?
That, and it's 3 o'clock. I should be home. None of us should be taking any after-school classes.
Well, it just so happens that I'm going to teach you a lesson that you can't learn from watching the news. Understand? I thought you maybe did. We're going to have a little project that will teach you all the value of money. Now, I'm going to divide you into pairs to work on this. Let's put Al with the L, Zoe with Joy. Oh, that's bad. Rose of, Tom. Ricardo and Cecilia, leaving May with Kyle. And what exactly do we have to do on the project? You'll see, let's go outside. I got a bad feeling here. Being blindfolded and shoved into a random room is never good. Yep.
All right, we're going to get back to the show. That clip is going on way too long. It's starting to bore even me. And I kind of like it. All right. Before we left, when we left off, we talked about, Mr. Dwight York, a.k.a. Imam Isa, leader of Ashur Allah Community Prophet, God Incarnate, the leader of the Nubian Nation of Moors, doctor, all of that. We're talking about all of that. Tesla, you're going to get fat. I hope you can get your cholesterol checked. Because that sounds really bad. Okay. We're moving on with the topic. Now, many black folks found this guy to be some sort of prophet, some sort of godlike figure. But even though he was exposed to be a criminal of the first order and a pedophile and so many other things, why did black people continue to support him? The answer to the first part is easy. At both the federal and local levels, authorities feared to move against York's various cults. At first, Islamic. Later, as an incarcerated god from space. Because they were afraid of being called racist, and crucified by the usual media gaggle, major networks, network news, Jesse Jackson, Al Sharpton, etc., for trying to oppress a black man. Political correctness demanded they adopt a hands-off attitude toward York's misdeeds. When York moved to Georgia, it became worse. Sheriff Stiles of Putnam County attempts to move against York brought out local civil rights. Representative Tyrone Brooks of Georgia, for one. Agitators and their defendants. And then Governor of Georgia Roy Barnes got involved. Roy Barnes, who quickly fell in with York's claims that Sheriff Stiles was a typical white person, i.e. a redneck sheriff who had it in for blacks, especially this peaceful brother from outer space. As in many cases where racial charges are lodged, the reality was the exact opposite. Far from trying to harm or oppress black citizens of his county, Stiles was trying to uphold the law and protect black children from abuse by a black man. Eventually, enough children managed to escape the cult, and York was convicted of child molestation. At that point, York's prior defenders, like Tyrone Brooks and certain Hollywood celebrities, Wesley Snipes for one, ran from the brother. Ran. Of course, now we know Wesley's in the pokey. They ran from Brother York like he was a rabid pit bull with AIDS. Now to the second and more intriguing question. How could reasonably intelligent black people fall for York's delirious and ever-changing scams? Well, for a brief period of their sojourn, for lack of a better word, to Georgia, York proclaimed that he and his followers were a long-lost Indian tribe. And, of course, he was Chief Black Eagle, of course, and he made his followers wear, for reasons known only to him, cowboy hats, hung Western belt buckles and cowboy boots. Huge cow belt buckles. And they were forced to wear these whenever they went out in public. As usual, the cult members were compliant with his bizarre wishes. Eventually, since York knew that having colorful costumes and pageantry was an important hook for his cult, he switched to first an Egyptian, then a Masonic motif. And how could the adults in his cult overlook the obvious signs of sexual abuse of their children? And then in many cases, still defend him once the castle of dreams had collapsed. Author. Well, author Bill Oninsky. Well, apparently he was puzzled by this question. And he interviewed many of the former cult members. And he concluded the juice that powered the cult and its numerous variations was always this message: hate white tea. This resonated perfectly in the black community. Oninsky concluded that York's cult members wanted to create a black utopia, i.e., something not sanctioned by whitey, and to have a religion that was not derivative of anything white. As one former member phrased it, ungodly. Because he is a black man, York, who waves the nationalist flag, pushing the black thing and downing the white man is the devil, according to this evil person. York knew that if the obligatory jab at whitey is used as lubricant, any nonsense can be shoved down the black throat. And ain't that the truth? Whether it's the belief that his followers will all be picked up by a spaceship and moved to safety before the apocalypse comes to level whitey, or that they are descendants of American Indians who must parade around in cowboy gear, or that they are physical descendants of Cleopatra, a Nubian ruler of Egypt. Never mind that Cleopatra was a Macedonian Greek and not an Egyptian. Well, why let facts get in the way? Hell, She was not an Egyptian, much less Nubian. But, you know, I grew up as a child with folks telling me all the time that we are descendants of kings and queens, every single one of us. It's kind of physically impossible unless we're all kin in that special way. But nevertheless, there's a thematic tie between all black religion or all black religious variations, cults, from the Moorish temple science of the early part of the 20th century, established in 1913, to Dwight York's cult and Reverend Wright's fevered rants. It can be summed thusly. The white man is evil and the root of all of your problems. Oh, and America is evil too. In fact, some of York's virulent rants to his followers: the white man is using birth control and AIDS to kill black people and is trying to turn the black man into a homosexual. Not that there's anything wrong with that. Could have been taken from the sermons of Wright. All of that could have been taken from any one of Reverend Wright's sermons. Or a host of other black liberation theology proponents. Just as Barack Obama explained how to handle white people and continues to utilize these principles even today, so Dwight York had a consistent method of handling black people. No matter in what direction York's scams mutated, several elements were consistent. Pageantry, cowboy boots and big old belt buckles and cowboy hats, or Nubian garb, or Masonic order clothing. No, costumes. All of that, along with a healthy dose, a core teaching that denigrates whites, blames them for the ills of the world, and predicts their demise. Since a great number of blacks are engorged with hatred of whites, this combination works time and time again. It would seem thus, with the pissed-off hordes of Wright, Obama, and York-type followers, though they have as much equality of opportunity as can be mandated by law, they still feel they cannot compete in a white man's world, or in a white world. Let's not forget the white ladies out there. Wouldn't want to be politically incorrect. Those that can make the grade rather than admit personal shortcomings. Those that can't make the grade, rather than admit personal shortcomings, need a scapegoat. They need somebody to blame. And I hear it time and time again every single day. Every single day. Well, not today, because I didn't leave the house today. But if I leave the house, I'll hear it. All I got to do is just, get in my car and drive down the road, maybe over to the Walmart, especially over at the Walmart. White America is the scapegoat, and anyone whose belief systems offer this plump goat up for the slaughter has a foot up with potential adherence. An apathy toward the white race may just sweep an evil racist or into the Oval Office, or has it already? Has it? I've spent a considerable portion of my life studying theories, from the logical to the bizarre, of history, mythology, politics, theology, sociology, psychology, and others that pertain to man and reality. If any nexus of truth exists in this mortal realm, be it paranoid or sublime, I've read it, thought about it, analyzed it, and measured it against known standards of truth. I've tasted both the wine and the vinegar, the VSOP and the dregs. As a result, I may not know what the absolute truth is, but I know a multitude of things that isn't. And Afrocentrism, and by extension, Black liberation theology, with its paranoid neo-racist keyhole revisionist view of history, is near the top of that list. White fright precedes white flight. White liberals do not publicly disagree with Black people, no matter how ludicrous their statements on history or reality. White conservatives, on the other hand, believe in the intrinsic equality of Black Americans and therefore treat them as equals to be challenged to defend what they maintain. It's not racist to disagree with someone of another race or culture. It's a racially or cultural bigotry, however, when one fears that opposing a person of another race or culture, since they consider themselves to be ideological, emotionally out of control, or potentially violent. When a presidential candidate like Barack Obama supported for 20 years in a world, and indeed a bitter, indeed a bitter, divisive, anti-American racist, like the Reverend Wright, and is also on public record as having apathy or antipathy toward white people, it's not only proper but mandatory to question his ability to lead Americans of all hues and persuasions. It would be intellectually stuporous of me to think logical persuasion could work on an Obamanite. Acceptance of Obama has nothing to do with logic. It's spawned by his supporters' core belief system, and core beliefs such as Black liberation theology can restrict acceptance of fact. The core belief system of the Japanese during the first decade of the last century included the idea that the Chinese were an inferior people and that the superior Japanese had the right to rule them. A few hundred years ago, the core belief system of the population of Salem, Massachusetts, accepted that witches made farm animals sick and crops fail. Obamanites accept that electing a person because of his skin color is more important than any policy he endorses. Logic and facts are useless against core belief precepts. One of Barack's core beliefs is that white people are untrustworthy. And I quote, "The typical white person," remark, and throwing his grandmother under the media train, are only the tip of the iceberg. In his autobiography, while listing the traits of a man he's just met and the reasons he doesn't trust him, the last reason Barack gives, and presumably the worst of all since the man's traits are presented in climactic manner was that the man was white. This animus against white people runs deep, and against experience in Barack's case, as in other, you know, as in others where children of mixed black and white parentage are concerned. Again, one boggles at the typical black thought process. And I feel very comfortable saying that now that Obama has made racial stereotyping an accepted thing, again, or the mixed race thought process, thought that the black father contributes sperm, then vacates the scene, and then the white mother raises and cares for him, and the thought that his white grandparents support and nourish him, he disrespects them because of their whiteness. Another example that comes to mind is the actress Halle Berry, abandoned by her black father, raised and nurtured by her white mother, gives a leg up, is given a leg up in Hollywood by a white director, and supported by white fans. She has still, against all reason and experience, found reason to express public bitterness at white America and dissatisfaction with her life in America. Oh, yeah. An incredible number of blacks in America seem to buy into stereotypes of whites. Whites are either rich Republicans or redneck bigots. This is, to a degree, understandable since the media, who obstinately decry the use of racial cultural stereotypes, makes every effort to support the use of negative images of the white conservative community. Conversely, while the image of a lazy, big-lipped black man sitting cross-legged eating a watermelon is recognized to be simply a negative stereotype, the image of the Republican as a corrupt, cigar-smoking, greedy banker is more of a Republican logo than the elephant. These days, the typical Republican is more likely to run the transmission shop down the street than to be a fat cat banker. American blacks have simply embraced the racism and bigotry they formerly decried as unjust and un-American. Racial bigotry is alive and well in America. It just has a darker face these days, a smiling face, the face of perhaps Barack Hussein Obama. The culture of dysfunction in the lower class of black America, i.e. the ghetto. It seems that most unwed state-supported egg donors are more concerned with making sure their kids are named with an incomprehensible jumble of pseudo-African syllables than with seeing that they learn that carjacking and drive-by shooting is a bad thing. I'll be damned if I'll utter Saisha, Kanisha, Shaquinta, Shaquila, and all of that. I want, if I can't pronounce it, and if I have to work at it to pronounce it, you're just going to be miss and ma'am. And even that's depending upon my mood. Not only will, when black folks went and voted for Obama, the man who thinks common civility is a trick he can play on white people. Well, it's been another way to get whitey. But there's every expectation that if a brother is president, even more manna will fall from heaven. Free food, free housing, free medical care, and simply not enough poverty. Few seem to realize that, taken as a unit, Black America is one of the richest nations on earth. The poor of the third world do not have cell phones and color TVs. Oh yeah, I'm going to be blunt here because the show's about to end. So please have the children and the liberals leave the room. The often understated opinion of many non-Black Americans is that, on the whole, Black Americans are a bunch of ungrateful whiners who will never be satisfied. And I could not agree more. And this is coming from a Black man. It's not in our emotional fabric to be content. We are a contentious lot. We have oceans of public housing teeming with welfare women. It doesn't seem right to let mothers roll off the tongue when speaking of these women, whose purpose in life is to breed like cockroaches and soak up the largesse of the American public. This is not white America's fault. This is not Oriental America's fault, nor Hispanic America's fault, nor anybody else's. In the main, Black leadership in America has failed to accept responsibility for the descent of Black American culture into the abyss of meaninglessness, cocaine, basketball, and hip-hop. What was our president doing just a few days ago? Filling out his basketball NCAA slots while the world burned around him, while there are wars and rumors of wars, while there are earthquakes and tsunamis, our president filled out his basketball brackets on ESPN and had it published for all to see. Instead of extolling the virtues of education and a good work ethic, Black folks instead scream for more government benefits and reparations? Reparations for slavery? The Great Society, the welfare state, food stamps, Medicare, affirmative action, and the financial support of a thriving underclass of women in ghettos who mainly breed more educated, uneducated criminals and are more welfare women. More welfare women have been a pretty good dip in that bucket. And to that, the cost to the United States is to pursue, capture, try in court, and then contain the more vicious of these thriving state-supported thugs and hoodlums. And I could go on and on, but the show is about to end. I want to thank everybody for listening. We're going to finish this up tomorrow. There's no doubt, because I'm not done yet. But the show's about to end, so I got to go. Tesla, thank you for listening. Everybody else, thank you for listening on your computers, in your homes, on iTunes, wherever you are. Thank you. God bless you all. And we will talk again tomorrow. It has been a great day. And I have thoroughly enjoyed it. Oh, my goodness. What a world we are living in. Could we start again? I don't know. Let's find out. Good night, everyone. Thank you.
Could we start again?